Review. During the first session of the 13th Alaska Legislature, Alaskan Legislative Review brought to our listeners informed discussion of important public issues featuring the faculty and staff of the University of Alaska at Fairbanks. Now that the legislature has adjourned, we are turning our attention to discussion of those issues with the legislators themselves, particularly the members of the Interior Delegation. Our guest today is Representative Bob Bettesworth. Representative Bettesworth was elected as a Republican from Fairbanks in 1978. He has since been re-elected twice, making him the senior representative in the Interior Delegation. Representative Bettesworth has served on numerous standing and special committees during his service in the legislature, and currently is chairman of the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee, vice chairman of the House Finance Committee, and he served as one of the three House members on the FY84 Conference Committee on the Budget. Representative Bettesworth has lived in Fairbanks since 1948 and is self-employed in the construction industry. Bob, welcome to the show and thanks for being with us. You are a member and an acknowledged informal leader of the House Majority Coalition, which has been much in the press this past session. I'm not sure that many people are aware exactly of why the coalition came into being and what it is. So could you tell us a little bit about it and why you are in it?
Coalitions are something that have been come to the forefront in Alaskan politics fairly recently. Normally, we've had pretty much straightforward party politics in the legislature. The first coalition, which is a mixture of Democrat-Republican philosophies to form an organization to operate the government, first took place in the Senate a number of years ago. It hasn't been generally understood by the populace, whether this is a problem of the media or not, that there is a coalition in the Senate, and has been for a number of years. The first coalition in the House actually took place after the demise of the Republican leadership late in the session of 81. So there's been two full sessions under the Republican leadership in a House coalition composed of, this year was 19 Republicans and, or 20 Republicans and 6 Democrats. Those Democrats being part of the former Democrat organization who became disenchanted and disgusted with the leadership of the former Democrat organization and chose to break away and form what they felt was to be a more productive, a more viable organization with the Republicans. And the Republicans were happy to do that. We're happy with those Democrats. They're conservative, responsible, reliable people, are easy to do business with, and we've gotten along very well.
All right. So, yeah, you're referring to the now infamous coup of June of 1981.
Right.
And the coalition was controversial then and has been involved in controversy again here 2 years later. In terms, you have stated that you would like to explain the coalition's point of view, feeling with some justification that only one side of the story has been told in the press. So one reason why I asked you here is I wanted to give you the opportunity to explain the coalition's side of the events that took place regarding the confirmation hearings for the governor's appointees and the joint session that was held in June. So here's your chance.
Okay. If I get too long-winded, why don't
all right.
don't hesitate to change the subject a little bit. I'll try to be as short and concise as possible, but it's not a simple subject. I'm happy with the coalition, the actions the coalition has taken. Some of those actions, I'm sure, have been suspect by the public, and I can readily understand why they might be, and I will do everything I can to try to clear it up. Okay, the coalition has had goals, and I would not hesitate to say that probably the first time in the history of the House legislature, the organization, they have had positive, written down, publicly announced goals or an agenda to accomplish during their legislative session. Okay, the House coalition, one of its first priorities when we took over two years and a couple of months ago was to try to establish a limit on the session length. And today, one of the things that the public is most unhappy about, from what I hear on the street anyway, is the length of the session. Well, this is a chance to say that this is not the longest session in the history of our legislature. It's only the second longest.
Missed it by a couple of days.
Right. But,
yeah.
A couple of days. But anyway, to set the tone from where I am coming from, as far as I'm concerned, the fact that we accomplished after 5 years of trying, because this has been a goal of the Republicans, even when we're not in a leadership position or in a majority, we have always submitted legislation for a 120-day session. An advisory vote on 120-day session was passed overwhelmingly by the voters of Alaska, but ignored by the legislature over a period of years because it was strictly an advisory vote. So the House Republicans have felt that it has to be a constitutional amendment of a 120-day session to get the legislature to adhere to the demands of the public. If that's what it takes, so be it. We have been trying for 3 years now to get that 120-day limit passed through both houses of the legislature. This year, we accomplished that. I stated early on that if we had to stay here till the 4th of July or Labor Day if necessary, it would be worth it to get that one issue, the 120-day limit, passed. And it is passed. It's an excellent piece of legislation. It will be on the ballot in November of next year. It calls for a 120-day limit. It calls for one 10-day extension by a two-thirds vote of each house, not a joint session, but of each house. And by that piece of legislation, I think some of the problems that we've had in people making a career out of the legislative process, which many of us strongly believe is not necessary, that it should be a citizen type legislature, go down there, do what has to be done, come back to your regular areas of endeavor. That's one of the things that the coalition accomplished. Aside from that, after 25 years of statehood, we passed the strongest package of criminal legislation that has ever been passed. Due to the liberal legislature that's been down there, criminals have been treated better than our university students or military personnel or anybody else as far as rights, which I personally believe they have forfeited when they commit a crime against society. We're trying to reestablish the fact that you can't get away with criminalizing the public and be treated as a regular citizen, and that's what they have asked for, and that's what the liberals have actually given them. We've got a strong drunk driving bill to get drunks off the streets. We've very controversial raising the age limit to 21 finally got passed. It was one that I was opposed to, having been just old enough to remember Depression days and the fact that prohibition doesn't serve the purpose. I think our young people are responsible, and changing the age that you can drink isn't going to change the number of drunks on the streets, in my opinion. However, be that as it may, that's going to be also on the ballot
right.
next year.
And this was another coalition priority.
Coalition priority. Those people who are of age now will be grandfathered in, so to speak, until after the vote next November. We passed strong legislation on pornography, on drugs, drunk driving.
And all this, the House was fulfilling its agenda. The coalition was fulfilling its agenda.
Correct.
How did all this lead into the conflict and the controversy that we saw over the governor's confirmation hearing?
Well, in my opinion, the news media blew that all out of proportion as to what it was really intended. As you know, by the 1st of May, by the middle of April, the House was on schedule for accomplishing budget work, bill work, and so forth for a mid-May adjournment. And the Senate was going along with the mid-May adjournment. It was pretty much understood that with the work we had to do, it was being done, it was going along, we were going to make it by mid-May, which is just a little over 120 days, but that's fine under the circumstances. However, long about the end of April, the House had substantially completed its budget work. It had completed most of its priority legislation, had it sent it over to the Senate side for action, and we're right on schedule for a mid-May adjournment 2 weeks later. At this time, we'd had some confrontations with the governor over how to appropriate the capital budget. Now, this is something that was established several years ago. The House, Senate, and governor pretty much agreed to figure out how much money we wanted to spend. Then each body would take their share of the capital and allocate it out accordingly. This governor was reluctant, very reluctant, to go along with that kind of allocation. So after much bargaining and much haggling and getting nowhere with the governor's office, the Senate and the House jointly decided to put together the capital budget amongst the House and Senate. The Senate had already put together four major capital bills that composed almost $500 million in themselves. A lot of projects that were unnecessary and that they knew probably would not be funded. So rather than coming up with what the House would maintain would be a realistic capital budget, the Senate bowed their neck and said they wanted their four capital bills, which excluded most everything the House felt was necessary. So there was definitely a confrontation three ways over the capital along about the 1st of May. There was a three-week period when absolutely nothing took place on the capital budget, which ran beyond our proposed adjournment date. From that time on, it was pretty much a negotiating, jockeying for position, trying to keep things moving, but trying to keep a reasonable attitude, a reasonable conversation mm-hmm. going between the different bodies, including the governor. And there was a period for almost 30 days when that was not happening.
It seemed that communications broke down pretty
communications
totally.
Communications broke down because we couldn't agree. The Senate says, you put our capital bills on the floor and vote them up or down. Well, we didn't think that was necessary because all of those things could have been incorporated into a capital budget that was mutually agreed upon. Well, that didn't come about. So basically, the last 6 weeks of the legislative session were probably taken up with the formation of a capital budget. The operating budget between the House and the Senate by the 1st of May was very close on all of the operating items. There was no controversy, no problem. When we went to conference committee between the House and the Senate, the operating budget was taken care of in just a matter of a day or two. The only last item was the University of Alaska budget, which I held out for to the bitter end, trying
always
to get some more bucks.
Always a perennial hard one
but
to
anyway,
deal with anyway.
That's another okay. subject. To go back a bit as to why the House asserted itself. We tried to assert ourselves as an independent body a year ago and failed, and the Senate and the governor got together and did what they wanted to do in spite of the House, and the House lost its bid for some kind of autonomy. And when I say autonomy, in my opinion, for years, almost since statehood, the House has been treated sort of as a poor stepchild to the legislative process in the fact that there's a greater turnover in the House. They don't have the experience. When you really want to make a career out of politics, you go through the House for a period of time. You move on into the Senate. So give credit where credit's due. The Senate has some very experienced veteran legislators who know the process inside and out better than most House members ever get a chance to do unless they become senators.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, in my opinion, the Senate and the House have gotten together to take advantage of the House, and House leadership previously, a minority of the House leadership, which is really what caused the infamous coup of 81, is four or five people who are the leadership, the Speaker, Majority Leader, Finance Chairman, Rules Chairman, and so forth, would get together with Senate leadership and get a few goodies for themselves and go along with whatever the Senate and the governor wanted. Now, I don't think that's proper legislation. It's not the best thing for the state of Alaska or anything concerned. There's been conversation previously about a unicameral legislature, such as they have in Nebraska. There's been bills introduced in the House and the Senate both over the years for a unicameral legislature, but it didn't get anywhere because basically they've been operating something like a unicameral legislature in that the Senate has always called the shots.
All right.
Okay, this year we established once and for all that the House was going to stand up and be an independent body and work out how the legislation was going to proceed with the Senate on an almost equal basis and have three bodies, the House, the Senate, and the governor. And I don't think the governor or the House, or the Senate rather, believed that we would do that. So primarily, the House had asked for a joint session to confirm commissioners on Friday. For some reason or other, the Senate and the governor decided that the House was not sincere, and I could state right now that the House was definitely sincere and had that regular, honestly called joint session come across, all the commissioners would have been confirmed. For some reason or other, the governor and the Senate convinced themselves that the House was trying to dump all of the governor's appointees, which is absolutely incorrect.
But there were, on the House side, there were quite a bit of controversy over at least the Attorney General.
There was a lot of controversy over the Attorney General, but had that vote come to the floor, there would not have been more than six or seven votes against the Attorney General out of the House. We are constitutionally required to hold hearings and inquire into the background of these people. The Senate side did not hold a single confirmation hearing. They were taken just passed. No debate, no discussion, nothing. The Senate just, they came up before committee, they were approved, and that was it.
How about the Senate's argument is that the House was withholding confirmation hearings as a political weapon in order to get some of its legislation through the Senate and hopefully onto the governor's desk for his signature. What's your reply to that?
Yeah, that's true. Every House, everybody, for years, has used whatever method they had at their hand at the particular time to force legislation. Yeah, there's no question about that. You use what things you have. The argument was made that normally confirmation hearings are held early on. This is absolutely incorrect. Our rules chairman had a calendar sitting on his desk during the last 30 days of the session showing the length of the session and the day in the session when the confirmation hearings were held. And on the longest session we ever had, the confirmation hearings were held the day before adjournment.
So confirmation hearings, per se, have never been a big issue.
That's right.
In the legislature.
Never been a big issue. As far as I'm concerned, a couple of our committees had some legitimate reasons for holding up confirmation hearings because they'd ask for information about commissioners that were not submitted. That is a constitutional mandate to ask questions, to ask for material, ask for background, to make sure that these people are competent. And that's fine. That didn't happen. They didn't even attempt to do it on the Senate side. The House tried. It was getting far enough along in the session that the Speaker of the House says, well, that's the way they want it. Well, they would go ahead and hold confirmation hearings. Now, why the Senate and the governor felt that it was so important to hold an illegal confirmation just 3 days prior to an already agreed-on session with the House, that is beyond comprehension. There is controversy over not showing up at that joint session. The House had, as I previously stated, completed its work. We had all of our priority legislation was on the Senate side. Our budget was completed. Everything we needed to do was done. The Senate had acted on no House bills. There was no Senate or House work over in the House for us to do. So we adjourned. We adjourned one to get the attention of the Senate and the governor that we meant business. We constantly were willing to talk and did try to talk to the governor and the Senate leadership to no avail. There were many meetings called where the House showed up. the Senate wouldn't show up, or the governor wouldn't show up, or immediately a confrontation would take place and the meeting would break up.
And in the end, the joint session was called. The House was adjourned at the time the session was called, and there are some serious constitutional issues that are going to have to be resolved. Obviously, the coalition believes that the session was legal. I believe we could spend easily another few hours doing this, but we're running short of time, so I'd like to ask you some other questions. But
if I can make just a quick summation on that subject. The public, rightly or wrongly, that's for the public to decide, has chastised the House for not attending that meeting. The House sincerely believes that it was an illegal, unconstitutional meeting. We're required by our oath of office to uphold the Constitution and act as gentlemen and responsible legislators. In our opinion, it would not have been responsible, it would not have been doing our job to have attended that illegal meeting and sanctioned something that we believe to be incorrect. If it can be done one time, it can be done again and again and again. And somebody has to take the responsibility to stand up and act like constitutional legislators. And if you don't, it gets worse, not better.
All right. Well, I'm glad to hear the coalition side of things. I imagine we'll have to wait and see what the courts say. And there are some other points of view, but I'm glad to hear that. I had a lot of questions. I wanted to ask you about your impressions of the governor, him being of the other political party from your own, and him being a freshman. As far as being a politician goes, putting aside what may be some bad feelings from this session, do you think that the coalition and the governor are going to be able to have a good working relationship in the next 3 years?
I would certainly hope so, and I believe that the coalition and the governor will have a meeting of the mind, so to speak. Personally, I like the governor. I fully agree with where I believe that he wants the state to go. His platform is very much the same as the House Republicans' platform. Just how to get there's a little difference. I think he's done a great job in maintaining his sense of humor, and he's cool because he has gotten something of a bad time from both the House and Senate, but I really admire him for the way he's handled himself and the way he's kept up his humor. We've been in confrontations in the Capitol building all day and had an occasion to attend a function at the governor's mansion that evening, and he's been a most congenial host, and he's a great guy.
He seems to be able to put politics in its place then.
He really, really can. Does an excellent job, and I certainly hope we can get together and go down the same road with the same ideas and accomplish them.
Well, I'd like to ask you about the legislative pay raise, which is on the minds of many people. Some Alaskans are becoming a bit cynical about the legislature and the way it conducts itself, the way individual members have been appearing more frequently in what it seemed to be serious conflict of interest cases. How did you vote on the pay raise bill, and why?
I wrote a lot of letters to constituents saying that I would not vote on the pay raise. But in the end, I did. I was on the Finance Committee when it came up from other committees and has to go through there because it involves dollars. I did vote in favor of it after long hours of soul searching and much arm twisting by constituents and fellow legislators mostly. And I have opposed the pay raises. Every year there's almost been a pay raise bill in favor of legislature since I've been there, and I've always opposed them. This time I didn't. And there are probably several reasons why I did not and why I support the pay raise, and I'm happy for the opportunity to bring out my impressions anyway. We have said ever since I've been in the legislature that we want citizen legislators. We want people to go down there, get the work done, come home, get back into the real world where they can know what the real world is rather than the political world or the legislative world, and I fully agree with that. However, we've had enough people down there lately who tend to enjoy the process. I enjoy the process, but I don't think it's necessary to extend it to 6 months. after the 5 years that I've been down there, I'm more convinced than ever that everything that should be done and needs to be done could be done very efficiently and very effectively in less than 90 days. I firmly believe that and would like to debate it for as long as anybody would care to debate the issue. Okay, that I'm convinced of. But because the legislature tends to get extended and tends to get extended after you've been there, say, over 4 months, the chances of you going back home and resuming the job you might have left or finding a part-time job that would carry over for the rest of the year, there's actually been a concerted effort on the part of too many legislators to extend it solely for the purpose of making enough money through their per diem payments to make their year's wages. Okay, the per diem is $80 a day. It is not taxable. If you are prudent, you can save $1,000 or $1,500 a month on your per diem payments, and after 4 or 5 months, that's a pretty good nest egg to carry over with your regular legislative pay. Okay, we've been trying to shorten the session. I'm convinced that that's one of the reasons the sessions have got longer, is people just stayed there long enough to make a year's wages, so to speak, or enough of a year's wages they could get by. The combination of a adequate compensation for going down there, whether it be for 3 months or for a year, you're going to get X number of dollars whether you're there for 1 day or 365 days. There's no incentive whatsoever now to extend the session because of pay. You're going to get so much and that's it. Okay, the per diem was removed. Now, personally, this does not constitute a pay increase.
Mm-hmm.
Because being prudent, you can save money on your per diem, which is not taxable.
Okay.
Now then, all of it is all regular wages, taxable income, and will be fully taxable.
And you think, we have to end the show, but you think the effect will be to shorten the session?
That is my opinion.
Okay, and one quick one. Do you think it will be an incentive to draw a higher caliber of candidate?
Exactly, and I was glad you gave me a chance, or glad that you made that statement.
It's been offered as a rationale. I wonder...
With the combination of the 120-day session, which the voters will pass a year from now, an adequate pay, better people will stand for election because they can see that if they don't get a job during the interim, they can have enough that they can make the commitment for 2 years, they can get by for a couple of years or 4 years, but it's sufficient monetary return that they can make that commitment.
Okay.
And even though we've asked for citizen legislators, because the legislators themselves have tried to be good legislators and respond to constituent requests, there's not a day go by in the year, whether you're in the legislature or not, that you don't have a lot of requests and a lot of time on the telephone, on the street, wherever you are, talking to constituents. We have provided that response, we have provided that service, and it's being demanded by the public more and more and more.
All right. Thanks a lot, Bob. We're real short on time. Thanks so much for being on the show.
Okay. Glad to be here.
Okay.
Anytime.
This has been Alaskan Legislative Review. Alaskan Legislative Review is a production of KUAC FM at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. Our executive producer is Carla Tonella. I'm your host, Scott Sterling. Thank you.